Welcome, everyone, to Diverse Joy, a podcast where two so-called experts put the joy back into conversations about diversity. Yes. And starting with today's episode and going forward into our future episodes, I'd also like to officially welcome our producer, Eric Roman Bining, who we finally have hooked up on a mic so that he can verbally interject when needed, and, yes. and you, the listeners, can hear his lovely voice.
Yes.
My co-host is the amazing, the brilliant, the spring-colored Dr. Amber Nelson.
Yes, and my co-host is the illustrious and colorful and slightly wet as he just spilt some water on himself, Dr. Will Cox. And as we know, we like to start our shows off with, like, what brings us joy. So in this springtime, April episode, what is bringing you joy, Will?
Well, one thing that's bringing me joy, something that happens twice a year, at least, or I believe it's exactly twice a year, something that we have in Madison called Gallery Night.
Ooh.
And so a bunch of the like little shops and stores all around our downtown area, and along the and some into the outskirts of town open up their doors to local artists and display the art from the local artists and have like some wine and cheese.
Oh, fun.
And usually the artists are there as well, so you can meet them. And we just get a little group of our friends together and we kind of bounce from place to place, look at the art, meet the artists, buy some art. Especially after we've had a little too much wine. And it is just a whirlwind and a blast and so lots cool. and lots of fun.
That's so good. Yeah. Love that.
So how about you, Amber? What's bringing you joy this April?
This time of year, we are just kind of coming out of peak cherry blossom season. And I live in the Pacific Northwest in Oregon, just outside of Portland, Oregon. And there are cherry blossoms, first of all, everywhere. But downtown, right along the waterfront, there's just rows and rows of cherry blossoms. And they're so beautiful when they're in bloom. And it's just beautiful, bright, well, not bright, like light pink flowers, and just it's just gorgeous. But this time of year, the blooms, the flowers are falling off the trees, which you think is sad, but it's actually so beautiful. I love the like raining of pink petals,
like pink snow,
and then it covers the sidewalks with these beautiful pink and like full. It's like lush. Deep rows of like pink petals, and I always feel like I'm like, oh, am I a bride? Like I'm walking down like aisles of flower petals, and it's just gorgeous, and it just feels luxurious and just beautiful. It just adds so much just like life and color to it. I was watching something, they were talking about romanticizing their life, and that to me feels very like I should be hearing like Parisian music in the background as I'm like walking through the cherry blossom petals. Aww, so yeah, that's my favorite thing. I love it this time of year.
I have two cherry blossom trees in my yard, in my garden. They're still young though, so they only have a few blossoms this year, but as they grow over the years, I look forward to getting enough to have some pink snow on my own.
Yes, it's the best. It is the best.
Amazing. Well, today's topic, so it's a word that gets bandied around a lot, sometimes by academics, sometimes by activists, sometimes by anti-social justice activists. And I think it's often misused and misunderstood. And that word, I'm building lots of tension here.
All the tension. Like, what is the word? It's like, what's in the box?
That word is intersectionality.
Intersectionality.
Like a big scary word to some people. So Amber, I'd love to have you kind of start us off. What's intersectionality?
Yeah, well, you're right. There are so many definitions. There are so many ways of understanding it. And there's a quote by Audre Lorde that is not specifically about intersectionality, but it is how I fundamentally understand it.
Sure.
And she says, there is no such thing as a single issue struggle because we do not live single issue lives. Meaning that we have multiple parts of ourselves, multiple parts of our identities that then intersect in different places and different times and different spaces, right? And it really came out of Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw's work in 1989, I believe. I'm just double checking my notes, 1989. And she defines it specifically as the relationships among multiple dimensions and modalities of social relationships and subject forms. It really started as this idea that my identity, Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw is a Black feminist. And so she was talking about that when we started talking about feminist movements or issues in feminism, it centered white women's experiences. And that there were things about the white woman's experience as a feminist that did not translate to the same as a Black woman and a Black woman feminist experience, right? And so she was like, we have to think about things more intersectionally.
Which reminds me of the poem, mm-hmm. Ain't I a Woman?
Ain't I a Woman? Exactly. Yeah.
Do you remember the date? Or
it is Sojourner Truth.
Yes, Sojourner Truth.
Sojourner Truth.
I was like, oh no.
Yeah, it's Sojourner
Truth. I brought it up, but I was like, oh crap. I don't want to say the right name.
Sojourner Truth. 99% positive it's a Sojourner Truth. And I don't know if it was technically a poem, but it was in this conversation around like you put your coat down to help somebody over a puddle, but you don't do that for me, and ain't I a woman, right? Yeah. Like, and talking about that, she was really the first person to kind of...
criticizing ideas of white feminism.
Exactly.
Is how we would talk about it now. I think
right.
At the time it would be talked about differently. But
right. And you were, and off camera, you were talking about what it looks like in from a research perspective too.
Yeah, so this is something, and I'm going to talk about it... a little bit in terms of my research, but I want to be clear that it was not my like original idea. All due respect to Dr. Crenshaw and many others who have come before me. But so as a stereotyping and bias researcher, you know, I set up these rigorous scientific experiments where we're trying to say that race bias, for instance, causes a difference in how people get treated. Mm. And so how we often do that, we set up some kind of research study, some kind of interaction, let's say. And to operationalize race bias, we randomly assign people to interact with someone. Half the people get randomly assigned to interact with a white man. Half the people get assigned to interact with a Black man.
Yep.
And then we see how they treat them differently.
Right.
And that is race bias. Because if, you know, in a randomized controlled experiment, you're acting differently in one condition, that means whatever's different between the conditions causes the difference.
Right.
That's how we do all of science, or all of experimental science, at least. And the problem is, so that's how you end up defining quote unquote race bias in an experiment. Well, then we do some gender bias experiments and we randomly assign people to interact with a white man or a white woman. And that's gender bias, right? Well, the problem is, well, what about Black women?
Right.
Completely left out of all of that.
Right.
And then some people are kind of like, well, you know, it's both.
Right.
You know, Black women, they'll get the racism and the sexism.
Mm-hmm.
True on one level, but actually when you do experiments, it's not always that if you have four conditions, a white man, a white woman, a Black man, a Black woman, it's not necessarily the case that the Black woman gets treated the worst of all of them or the most. It's different qualitatively in many cases. And this is the idea that when within the intersection of race and I've been talking about race as just Black
and
white,
which
is another further issue that we should also acknowledge. But it's not just, these two dimensions that intersect, and if you measure one and measure the other, they add up. It's no, Black women have qualitatively different experiences. And we can't just understand them by looking at how Black men are treated and how white women are treated.
Right. Absolutely. And you're right. It's very easy to use the dichotomy of the black and white, and often is used in research because it's the, you know, we in research in particular like dichotomies, right? And so the furthest ends of the spectrum is white and black and white. But even in my own research, my dissertation, I looked at perceptions of black, white, and multiracial, right? And to see, like, is there a difference for somebody who identifies as multiracial? And so, yes, it's not necessarily additive. It's just, it's acknowledging that there are differences in the ways in which somebody is treated based on some of their identities. And I also like to talk about intersectionality. Is like, we have our we have personal identities, right? Around my personality and things that are personal to me, as well as social identities around our race, you know, class or socioeconomic status, our, you know, our ability, our, you know, other positions in our world, our religious affiliations. And the thing around intersectionality is that when people first hear it, they think of these things as static. One, it's just like, well, this is this and this is this, and they kind of overlap. But really, it's dynamic in that how those things intersect, what it means for me and to navigate the world as a Black woman in rural Oregon looks very different than it means for me when I lived in Baltimore, Maryland, right? Two, same identity, right? My identity didn't change as a Christian identifying Black, you know, fat bodied woman was the same here as it was there. But the ways in which it was interpreted, how I navigated those spaces was very different. And so we're taking into consideration like time and space, what's happening in the socioeconomic, you know, sphere, and where are you and how does that interact? In some of those places, you'll be part of the majority. When I'm in Baltimore, I'm part of the majority from a racial standpoint. When I'm in Oregon, I'm always one of, if not the only one in many of the spaces, right? And so what it means to occupy this body, these identities there mean something very different in different places and spaces.
Yeah, and I something I really like that you just brought up, so in the like experimental examples I was talking about, it was talking about the bias side of things. And what you're talking about is the intersections of things that shape your perceptions as well and how you see the world, how you interact with it. Some people who kind of maybe run amok a little with this term for
or criticize it
or criticize that. That's part of what I meant. Like they see it as like, oh, you're stacking up the victimhoods. I think I might be getting ahead to what our question is later, but it's not just that. It's just like how I see the world is of course a product of the intersection of identities and experiences that I have. And just, if you want to understand me, understanding that is part of it. It's not necessarily the bad things, like what you just described about Baltimore versus Oregon and how you interact with them. It's not necessarily saying anything negative, it's how I figure things out, how I go about my life, how I, you know, make sense of the world around me. And I think, of course, the intersections of our identities are gonna be a part of that.
And one of my favorite buzzwords my students will tell you, I say both and bidirectional. Like they they know if they write bidirectional on a test, they will at least get a point because it is, it is the thing. They're like, Dog Nelson, both and bidirectional. Like those are the things. Like it's because it is not just, it's not just other people's perceptions of me and my identities. It is also how I interact with them and how that I interact with the environment. So it is this bidirectional relationship around identity and intersectionality and what that means. And so I think that that's really important. And it's also really hard to talk about intersectionality without also talking about privilege or power. And I think that's really what you're bringing up, right? Like it's not just the place places of oppression and marginalization. It's not like I'm black and I'm fat and I'm a woman, so I have like the lowest power. I have the lowest privilege.
You also have a doctorate.
But I also have a doctorate.
You're a professor.
I'm a professor. I make good money. I have access to things. I have a car. I have a home. I have, like, there's so many. I also identify as Christian. And in this country in particular, that is a privilege, yeah, right? I have access to speaking the language that is the majority of this country. You know, like, there's so many other things. And that's how all of those things interact. Like, some of those things, when I talk about privilege, sometimes people will get really activated by hearing.
Absolutely.
Oh, sorry, the doggos almost knocked over our set. So,
yeah, we have a dog visitor today. We've mentioned him in an earlier episode that he was in the background. So, apologies, we had a slight dog disruption. Ezra's cousin Archie is here today. He's here about like kind of 1 week out of the month at our house, where our studio is, because his father travels around the world for work. And they were getting in a little fight and knocked into some lights. But we are back. And we started kind of getting into what the question was. So we're just going to go out of order today and add the question to the main topic. The question was going to be, and still is, but now we're moving it up. Yep. So intersectionality is about adding up identities for victimization, right?
Right. No.
No. I will say I have known some people who have tried to use it like that. Like, I'm definitely not going to name the person,
right?
But they started the conversation saying, as a and they named every identity that they could possibly, even in the most tenuous way, claim. And they were trying to make it like that makes me the biggest authority
on all of these things.
And it was unfortunate because it set a bad precedent for the students who were in the audience of this particular thing I'm thinking of.
Right.
And I can't be more detailed without, I'm not trying to call out a specific person in that way. But that's not really the point.
Right.
And there's this expression, there's no such thing as the oppression Olympics.
Right.
Like, we're not trying to make those things competitive. No.
And it really is. It's saying like we're acknowledging differences in approach or differences in experiences. And from a clinical perspective and the ways that I talk about it with my students, you think about a gestalt, which is a German term. And there's like this foreground and background. And some identities are going to be more in the foreground in some situations and more in the and some in the background. And in other situations, it will flip. Again, the same way that what it means for me to be a Black woman in rural Oregon, where I'm the only one versus one of many when I'm in Baltimore, right? Like, my identity as a Black woman, it changes, shifts, right, as far as how I interact with and how others interact with me with that identity. Yeah. It's not about additive victimhood, right? But it's an acknowledgement that it's going to change.
More now, aspects of ourselves, absolutely. Many that intersect. And there's also the point that no one has more anymore than anyone else.
Right.
So if we're talking about intersection of race and gender and sexual, well, everyone has all of those.
Exactly.
So some of them might be considered traditionally more privileged or powerful ones, but you still have them. Everyone has the same quote unquote number of intersections, which is kind of a nonsensical term.
Right.
It's if you're looking at the idea of intersectionality, the way it was intended, it's not supposed to be something that you count like that.
Right.
Really.
And there are a couple like, not caveats, but additions, acknowledgments to this conversation, which is Kimberly Crenshaw really was talking about the additive effects of being a Black woman, right? That in kind of social situations that you have less power as a Black woman than a white woman does in comparison to a Black man is in comparison to a white man. So there are some, like, historically speaking, and in a lot of spaces, there is some of that that piece. And we see it come out in things like wage gaps, right? When we look at different ethnicities and different genders and different spaces, we do see disparities come out when we look at specific intersections.
Oh, yeah.
But when we talk about intersectionality as a much more global understanding to talk about identities, it's not about victimization or additive oppression. It is about saying, here are the places that I identify. I identify as a Christian. I identify as a Black woman. I identify as fat. I identify as cisgender. I identify as, you know, heterosexual. I identify of all of these things. And all of those cumulative pieces make me me, right? Exactly. And make me unique from every other person in these different ways in which all of the parts of my inner identity come together. And that's really what is what comes with that.
And it's a pushback against having the kind of very narrow focus on just one dimension.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, I it's hard for me to talk about intersectionality and identity without these two things. One is the social matrix, which is Jody Kilman from 2010. And the social matrix is... sounds like, you know, the movie Matrix sounds really fun and we're wearing the color green from Matrix, but it is a way to kind of map your identities, and you kind of, you draw a circle and you kind of write out, and Jody, Dr. Kilman gives tons of different identity markers in which you can kind of identify yourself on, whether that's even your parents' education, your education, where you grew up, and all of these things. And you kind of, you write out like what those things are, and it kind of creates your own personal identity wheel.
And to paint a picture for the purely audio listeners, because we'll probably have graphics for the video, it's a circle with lines in it, kind of like a starburst almost.
Yeah, with like where essentially you in the center. Yeah, absolutely. And then on top of that, you can then take the next level of saying, like, how much power or privilege do I own or do I have in this identity in certain spaces? And you can think about it in different spaces, and you can see how it shifts in different places, and you kind of draw a star on the line of that identity. Closer to the outer edge of the circle, more power or privilege you own or have. Closer to the center, the less power and privilege you might have in a certain space. And I always encourage people to do it multiple ways. One, thinking about different spaces. Map your identities and like thinking about at work, thinking about in your place of worship, thinking about in your friend group or wherever that might be, a social space. And then have a friend or somebody else say, like, here are all my identities. How do you perceive these things? Again, it's this like internal, how do I understand myself? But also, how does somebody else see and perceive how much power or privilege I might have with these identities? And the other thing that I always talk about too, when it comes to conversations around intersectionality and understanding how it interacts with our social space, is unpacking the invisible knapsack. And that is Peggy McIntosh. In 1989, I believe, I'm looking at Eric Roman, our producer, to double check that that's the time.
Right.
But I believe it's 1989. And she wrote this paper that has now become something that's really used in kind of social justice spaces and social advocacy spaces around, you know, understanding privilege in a different way. Like, oh, I didn't understand.
I mean, she started the whole idea of white
privilege.
Right,
exactly. And you talk about bias as unintentional bias, right? Like unintentional.
There's also intentional.
Right.
But for the average person.
Right. Yeah. We're like implicit bias as unintentional bias. And I like to talk about privilege as, again, it's a word that gets really activated. People get very activated by white privilege and privilege and things like that, because people have worked really hard to get where they are and to do all the things that they do and have access to the things they have access to. But I like to use the term unearned advantages, right? Like there are times that you have, just by way of whatever identity in that particular space, again, that can swap at any given moment or space or time, that you have an unearned advantage over somebody else that maybe have a different identity or identity marker than you. And that's really what that paper is about. She kind of talks through her day about like, oh, I can go about my space and it's not all white. Like, it's also a heterosexual privilege of saying like, if I have a ring on, I'm as a heterosexual person, then they assume that I'm married to a man. They're not incorrect, right? Like, there's a privilege to that. There's a privilege to being able to go into the grocery store and being able to, or drive and be able to read every single thing because this is my language, right?
Right.
And all of those things. And so, anyway, all of that to say that our identities interact in a variety of ways. Our personal identity, how we interact socially in all of our spaces. And it also, just like we were talking about disability last episode, it changes over time too, right? Like our age at this point as millennials, you know, we're both 38. Hopefully you're okay with that.
I'm 39 now.
39 now, right? That's right. And so, you know, we have a lot of privilege. We have a lot of power at this age where we're professionals. We have all these things. But as we age, we lose some of that privilege because people don't.
We're not young and exciting anymore.
Right, we're not young and hip anymore.
I'm not sure that I was ever young and hip. I don't know if I was hip, but I think you will always be
young and hip.
You're gonna be the fabulous granny with the sparkly glasses.
100%.
Everyone wants to be their grandma.
100%. Yes.
But totally hear what you're saying though. Yep. Yeah, those things change. They shift.
Yes. Yeah. And our identity shifts too, right? Like, people understand their gender differently as time goes on. People understand their sexuality differently as time goes on. People understand their religion, and different parts of their aspects of their identity can shift and change. And I think that that's a really important aspect when we talk about intersectionality, because people often think that it is stagnant, that it is like, well, I am white and I am this and I am this. Therefore, this is what my power and privilege will always be. This is what my identity will always be. When in fact, that's not true. Who I am today or who I am tomorrow is informed by who I am today and the experiences that I have today. And that I might have a really, really great experience or really traumatic experience today that then changes the way how I understand my identities or shift the way I identify tomorrow. And so I think that that dynamic aspect of recognizing that we're constantly in flux and that we should always be doing the internal work of how do I understand myself? What are the ways in which I identify and what does that look like in all of my spaces?
Awesome. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. So we're going to take our break now and then come back for some story time. Woo-hoo. So now we're going to go into story time. As always, we have one more difficult story, example of maybe a time that one of us faced prejudice or bias of some sort, and then a more positive story to kind of bring us back up and infuse that joy that we're all about. And we do that because, you know, just because our podcast is oriented towards this joy, doesn't mean we want to just completely avoid difficult topics, because of course that's just part of reality.
Absolutely.
And something that we always want to acknowledge and sit with while still moving things forward and figuring out better ways to do stuff.
Yeah.
And so today, Amber has brought a couple of stories that she would like to share.
Yeah.
So Amber, let's have some story time.
Sure. Yeah. You know, and kind of just bouncing off of what we're talking about as far as why we balance it with maybe some of the pain and the joy is, again, we don't want to, we're not talking about toxic positivity, right? Like, like, it's not just saying like, oh, we just have to like only be joyful all the time. These topics can be really challenging, can be really activating, and transformative. And there can be joy in the ways in which we talk about the conversations while acknowledging pain and things and when things have not gone well too. So for me, one of the, and I was thinking about like identity and times in which my identity has intersected with both positive and negative experiences. I remember a time when I was living in Baltimore and I had some electrical problem with my car. I don't know what was going on, but I had a headlight that would not stop going out. Like, I literally was getting that thing fixed once a month, if not more frequently. So I don't know what was going on. I don't know if they just didn't know how to change it, whatever the case was. I had a headlight that went out. And I was a postdoc at the time, and not because of my postdocs, that was not my postdoc's fault, as far as the training institution. I was just there really late trying to get a bunch of stuff done. So it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I left work maybe 2, and I was driving home and I got pulled over. And, you know, for Black folks, getting pulled over often can elicit a number of thoughts, experiences, and ways in which we interact with the police. And I got pulled over. I've not necessarily had a whole lot of negative experiences with police in my life. I've had a few interactions that weren't necessarily positive, but not necessarily super negative either. And yet I've also been really trained on what to do when I'm pulled over by a police. I put my hands on the steering wheel. I do not make any sudden movements. I wait until the police officer comes to the door and I tell them exactly what I'm doing. And I only move with one hand at a time. This is how I've been trained and how I've learned to interact with police when I've been pulled over. So when they pulled me over, I realized that I had put my purse in my backpack in the back seat. And that's where my ID was. And so when the police officer came up and asked for my ID, I told them, I didn't reach for it. I just said, my ID is in my backpack. It's in the back seat. And at the time, the police officer asked me to get out the car, pull my backpack out while they, you know, had their hand on their gun, and like, which I understand. They had me pull out my backpack and then proceeded to make me dump it on the street, and then had me sit on the sidewalk while they went through my purse to get my ID, and then made me sit on the sidewalk while they ran my ID, my plates, and everything. And then, you know, they were like, "Oh, okay. Well, oh, how do you say Oregon?" You know, and they were like joking with me, and I was like, "Oh, it's Oregon." As I'm like picking up all my stuff off of the ground and like putting it back in my backpack and in the car. And I left. And at that point, like, I think the adrenaline had like come down, and I remember just shaking and feeling like, oh my God, like that could have been so bad. If I had just, this is not long after Philando Castile and other shootings of folks in their car, you know, for different things. And I would just remember just being shaken, so shaken and just tearful, going like, oh my God, like, I'm thankful that this went as well as it did, but this could have been so bad.
Yeah.
And even just having to like the embarrassment, I was right out in front of my apartment, having to sit on the sidewalk while like the police are there and like searching through my things. And it was just it was a stop to tell me that my headlight was out and to get a fix it ticket. And I just had all these flashes of other people that looked like me that lost their life for the same or lesser things. And so even though it wasn't necessarily, it could have been much worse, it was just this really negative experience that I had.
Absolutely.
With police.
I'm so sorry that happened to you, and that we live in a world where that happens far too often.
Yeah. And, you know, from an intersectionality standpoint, somebody else that's going through the same thing might not have thought anything of it. You know, I was telling my friend who is identifies as white, and I was telling her this story, and she said, I never would have even thought to tell them that my ID was in the backseat. I would have just turned around, gotten it, and given it to the police officer. And she's like, but that even the idea that I wouldn't have even thought about that is part of, again, differential treatment in that situation.
Yeah.
And on the positive side, as far as a positive story, that I also want to balance in saying, like, I don't have only negative interactions with police officers either. And I work with two different set in two different settings where I work with police officers in the justice system. And one is the Oregon Youth Authority, and I'm part of an equity think tank where we have members of, you know, police. We have members of the community, social workers, just community members, part of the justice system that are there. And we're all working together on ways to help our incarcerated youth in having a better transition back out into the community once they leave the system. And I also am working, I work directly with police officers, or have had a lot of direct interaction and work with police officers through a youth-led organization that I'm on the board for, called Raising Justice. And it is, again, it's a youth-led organization working with the police department on how to reduce recidivism rates and how to reduce rates of interactions with the legal system, specifically for Black and brown youth, but youth in general. And the police system and the police departments that we've worked with have been so positive. They have wanted to learn. They've been so receptive to trainings and conversations, asking questions like, how do I work with youth and how do I distinguish these things, and giving them just a little bit of education around like development and trauma and how that manifests in youth and how we have, you know, can interpret things incorrectly and how you can work with them that ultimately can reduces negative interactions from the police officers with youth, and specifically Black and brown youth, that ultimately lead to reduced recidivism rates.
That's amazing.
Have been incredible and super positive, and it gives me a lot of hope for the future, hope for the system and working with the system and partnering with our law enforcement to make changes in our community too.
It's really amazing. Yeah. Thank you for sharing both the pain and the joy, as we sometimes say.
Yeah.
All right. We're back from our break. It was a little differently timed due to the little doggy action earlier. Yeah. But for those of you on video, these are our cute boys. This is me and the producer's special guy, Ezra, who's a bit better behaved than his young buddy, Archie.
Who doesn't want to be held, apparently.
Despite the fact that he's always whining for attention.
Yeah, there we go. So we are at the time where we're actually doing our habit-breaking skill, or bias habit-breaking skill.
Yeah.
So, Will, what is our skill today?
So today's skill is one of those tools, one of those things that, you know, with practice actually help us reduce bias or make bias less likely. This is one of the tools that helps us prevent bias, something you can kind of put in a place that makes bias less likely. And this tool is called seeking individuating information. And so I like to do an exercise to kind of get people to the point of this. So one of the things stereotypes do in our everyday lives is when we don't have a lot of information about someone, stereotypes come in and fill the gaps. They lead to those kinds of assumptions that we often talk about. So let's say, imagine a woman named Dorothy. Mm-hmm. This is actually a real woman, a friend of mine. But picture in your mind Dorothy, who is an 85-year-old white woman.
Mm-hmm.
Try to picture her. Those of you who are watching on film, on video, will be able to see a picture of her we'll put up. Now, if that's all I tell you about Dorothy, I've given you a kind of an intersection of a couple of her identities, kind of age group, race, and gender. Stereotypes will maybe start to come to mind.
Yes.
So for instance, we might think about Dorothy. Well, she's probably not very good with technology. Mm-hmm. That's what we tend to think about older folks. We might think, well, in her spare time, she probably enjoys knitting and sewing. It's kind of an intersectional thing with age and gender there to tie to today's overall theme.
Yeah.
If it was just an older man, we wouldn't think he would be knitting. It's not just about being old. It's not just about gender. So that's a little tidbit of intersectionality from a bias perspective. But if we're just kind of, we have these few identity markers over, we're picturing in our mind, these things are going to come to mind. Our mind is going to draw on stereotypes to kind of flesh out our idea of Dorothy. Now, to counteract that, let's say I give you some individuating information about Dorothy. So I can tell you, that contrary to stereotypes that would say she's not very good with technology, she was actually a pioneer in computer science. Wow. She worked in a computer science lab back in the 70s and 80s that did work that led to the infrastructure of modern day medical databases. That's something that's a really cool thing it's about amazing. Dorothy.
Yeah.
And it's something that happens to counteract stereotypes. Yeah. Some pictures I'll have Roman throw up in the video when he makes the video version of this. She used to go hang gliding.
Wow.
And she has this great picture of her about to like go hang gliding,
yeah.
which is really cool. She was an avid skier and would ski down like black diamond slopes, which are the really exciting, really dangerous ones.
That's awesome.
That really kind of showed off some of her skill. So all this is more individuating information about her. I can also tell you that matching the stereotypical ideas, Dorothy actually does like knitting and sewing. Now,
that's great.
Now that's something that matches the stereotype,
right.
but now it's a real fact about her.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with us having interests that may happen to match one of the stereotypes related right. to our groups.
Right.
The problem is the stereotypes leading to assumptions and discrimination
and bias.
Right. Rather than an assumption, it's better to get this individuating information. Mm-hmm. And one last fun kind of tidbit about Dorothy. So she doesn't like the way store-bought jeans fit her. And so she makes a lot of her own jeans.
That's amazing.
And she had this professional label printed for them that she sews into the jeans.
Amazing.
Her private jean label is Callipygon, which is the Greek word for nice ass.
I love that so much. I love that
and,
so much.
So like whenever she's wearing like jeans, I'm like, hey Dorothy, those are some of your nice ass jeans.
And that's I aspire to be like Dorothy. That's amazing.
So now all this, I mean, you know, we've spent 2 minutes tops talking about Dorothy, but that's all individuating information.
Right.
It gets you to know her as a unique individual. Mm-hmm. When you have that kind of information, your brain doesn't have as many gaps in your perception of her.
Right.
If you're trying to think about her, if we're in a situation where you need to make some kind of judgment or decision, it's going to be more driven by the real facts we have about her than the stereotypes, because there aren't gaps for those stereotypes to fill. So getting to know people as individuals, getting individuating information about folks, good way to prevent bias from even coming into play.
Right. Because once we know folks that and seeking that individuating experience, not only does that help us contextualize that individual person, but also it puts a chink in the armor, right? Of saying like, well, I know this one person that wasn't like that at all. Like, so maybe not all older people are X, Y, and Z, right? No. So it can not only help with that individual experience, but can also kind of break down some stereotypes and biases that maybe we have been perpetuating over time.
And it works in the way you're describing that kind of is a synergistic effect with one of the other tools we talk about, which is broadening your input.
Exactly.
So as you get to know this one particular person, it pushes back against the stereotypes. So someone else of the same group, you might not be as subject to biases related to them. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great connection. Well, and I, you know, speaking of Dorothy, earlier this week, we went and got massages from and one of the masseuses were masseuses, is that right?
Yeah.
Masseurs? I was like, how do you say that in plural? Masseurs was an older lady. And my first thought was, is she going to be able to do like a strong enough
deep tissue massage.
Yeah. And that was my first. But now, like afterwards, I actually asked, well, I was like, don't want to ask this, but was she able to give you? And you're like, yeah, she, of course she's a professional. Why wouldn't she be able to? And I was like, you're absolutely right. She's a professional. She's in this space. Why would she not be able to do that? My bias and my assumption was, oh, seems to be an older lady. Like maybe she's not going to have the strength to do that.
I had the same thing that came into my mind when I saw her as well. I have to admit, and was very pleased to be able to recognize that and for it to be wrong.
Yeah.
She was great.
And that information, at least again for me, is helpful for that broadening my experiences and seeking that individuating experience and recognizing like, again, this woman is a professional. She's in the space. She's working. Of course, she's able to, and presuming competence, which
I was waiting for a guest to say that. Presume competence. I want to credit for that one.
I'll give Will credit for that, for crediting Nikki. Presuming competence and not incompetence or inability, yeah. Right? So I think that there's so many things, right? That broadening your input, seeking individuating information, presuming competence, like all of those things, that's the synergy between them, can really help not only for the individual, but how we can break down some of the stereotypes that we hold.
And one of the additional ways to use this tool is when you notice yourself having assumptions about someone. Mm-hmm. So if you find biases popping to mind, say, oh, I must not know this person very well if I'm having these generalizations.
That's really good.
Them.
Yeah.
And then put this into practice, getting that individuating information.
Right.
So like in the case of the masseuse, masseur. Wait, which word is it?
I'm looking at
maybe they're
Roman.
Both right. Massage therapist.
Massage therapist.
In the case of this massage therapist, you know, if say we were interviewing a massage therapist rather than I was already signed up for it, so it was happening.
Right, it was happening.
You know, we might have had additional questions and be like, you know, we're looking for deep tissue massage. I'm trying to think in the moment, which is never a good thing for me to try to do. But, you might have sought the individuating information with her, had more of a conversation about what she does, how long she's been doing this, why it's her passion.
Right.
The more in getting to know her, you might have had more information that pushed out that like little assumption, like, oh, she's a weaker old lady.
Right.
Which was
or she's an old lady and I'm assuming
old lady
she's
and therefore
weak.
Yeah.
In this particular instance, she is a masseuse because she is a woman. If it had been a man, it would be masseur.
Oh. There's a gender difference in how you refer
French
to them.
Words.
Oh. So, but how then do you say it plural? Masseuses?
I think it would take the male.
Masseurs. Masseurs.
Uh-huh.
Plural of masseuse.
And masseuse is the female one? I've already forgotten.
Is not shown.
Well, but yours ended up being female too. So for us, this week it would be masseuses.
Right. Well, maybe. That sounds funny.
Masseuses. Those massage therapists.
A massage therapist. I think we could go. We can land
can
a massage therapist.
Which can include gender non-binary and other things.
I like that.
So yeah, seeking individuating information.
Yes, that's so good. I love it.
Awesome. Well,
great.
We always like to end with a
recommendation.
Masseuses.
It's masseuses. Okay.
We recommend masseuses. No. So something that brings us joy, and we looked at the pattern of alternating because we're trying to make sure we're both getting ours in.
Yes.
We have such long lists of things we want to
so
recommend.
So many things to recommend, y'all. So many.
Keep
things.
Listening to the podcast. Recommend it to your friends so we get more listeners. So we have an excuse to keep going.
Maybe
this.
We'll just have an episode where we just talk about only recommendations, all of the things that we want to tell you about.
But our official recommendation for this episode is a wonderful TV show that me and our producer Eric Roman Vining really love that we're planning to introduce Amber to because she not seen it. It's called Girls 5 Eva. So that's the number 5 in the middle.
Because 5 is better than 4.
Yes. And the premise of the show, so it stars Sarah Bareilles and many other great actresses that I'm not going to try to name, but maybe our producer can pull up the list. And basically, there was a girl group, kind of like a Spice Girls, you might imagine, from the 90s that were basically a one-hit wonder.
Okay.
And then they eventually broke up, and now it's kind of revisiting them in their late 30s, early 40s.
That's amazing.
Where they kind of try to get back together and have like a resurgence.
Love that.
And so it deals with a lot of 90s flashbacks, which is always fun. But it's a musical show. So every episode has at least one all new musical number.
Okay.
Many, if not all of them, composed and written by Sarah Bareilles, who
makes sense.
Amazing.
Makes sense. Yes.
And it's just hilarious. It was created by someone that Roman will throw in. Roman, who created it? I want to give credit to the amazing person. Yeah, right. It's the hilarious. Right people. Mm-hmm. And we're waiting for the producer. See, usually he interrupts us, but now that he has a microphone, we get to be like,
we can just like look at him and wait.
I have to turn the recording of my microphone on and off in addition to moving it in and out of my face.
So we can't just like look at you.
Girls 5 Eva was created by Meredith Scardino.
Right.
That name sounds
stars. Sarah Bareilles, Busy Phillips, Paula Pell, and Renee Elise Goldsberry.
Yes. Oh
my gosh. It also has Ashley Park recurring as Ashley, the dead fifth member of the group.
Yes.
and you said Meredith.
Meredith Scardino.
What? She's done some other things too.
She also worked on Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. And Mr. Mayor. That's
and
right. Okay.
By the name, she's Italian, yeah? Italian American Scardino.
Sounds
Italian. So the main character that Sarah Bareilles plays is Italian American and also works at an Italian restaurant, which, you know, so some of your culture in that
too.
Yes,
yes.
The whole thing is just, it is top tier hilarious, like of all the funniest, amazing. Best shows, funnier than some things that we've recommended on here. I would like, I can't think of a show that's funny.
I've never heard of this show.
All right, so we're going to show you some episodes.
I'm very excited about
this evening before we take you back to your hotel.
I love that.
But one little joke that happens. So if any of you listeners are familiar with Sarah Bareilles, amazing musical artist, she had a pretty hit song. Mm-hmm. I think it's called Love Song.
Yes.
And the lyrics go, you know, I'm not going to write you a love song because you asked for it. Mm-hmm. I'm not a singer, I apologize. And so there's this one episode where they're working on a new album and the record label is like, you know what, this is missing, we really need you to write a love song, please.
I like an assignment personally, because if there's no box, I'm just kicking air, and what's that all about, right?
What are you saying?
Tate's email. The label's hoping the album can have a love song.
I'm not going to write them a love song because they asked for it.
And she's like, I'm not going to write you a love song because you asked for it, which is like the lyric of this famous song of hers. And it,
I
was laughing so
gosh,
hard on the floor.
Like, so good. There you go. I love that. Well, it reminds me of, my last birthday, I was intent on seeing New Kids on the Block. I incorrectly assumed that it was a tour of their old stuff, but it was new things.
New
so it was like, it makes me think of that, of like this, like, you know, 90s boy band that hasn't done anything for a really long time and is now back together and touring. So.
Well, yeah. So hilarious. There are actually boy bands who kind of come in sometimes on the show.
One
of them was married to a boy band member and they were like, you know, the pop couple. And that's funny. Things that happen.
So funny.
Hilarious show.
Awesome.
Pretty good-ish racial representation. There are people of color as main characters who I think do a nice job.
Yeah.
Queer stuff coming through. One of the main characters is a lesbian, played by Paula Pell, who's an amazing, hilarious comedian.
That's awesome.
And the music is just bopping.
Phenomenal.
Bopping. Worth, like, I just listened to it on repeat. Great music. So it was originally streaming on Peacock. And the third season is going to be Netflix. And so presumably the first two seasons will also come to Netflix. That's not clear to us right now.
Okay.
But at the very least, Peacock or Netflix, you should be able to find it. It has gotten a lot of accolades, so it will be streaming somewhere for you. You also get to see an episode where Tina Fey comes in as a guest star. Playing Dolly Parton. Tina Fey impersonating Dolly Parton.
Tina Fey as Dolly Parton is reason enough to watch this
show. Hilarious.
If nothing else has enticed you to watch this show, watch it just to see Tina Fey as Dolly Parton. And that sound, you've hilarious. Sold.
All right. So, brings me lots of joy.
That's
I think. Beautiful piece of art.
And as a callback to our previous episode about interracial relationships and representation of such on TV, Sarah Bareilles' character is married to a black man and they have a mixed race.
Hey, love that.
He's a lonely New York boy.
Oh, I can't wait to see it. All right, sold.
All right, so, well, So that was my recommendation for Joy this episode.
Love it.
As always, I'm Dr. William Cox.
And I'm Dr. Amber Nelson.
Produced by Eric Roman Bining. With music by Jay Arner. Diverse Joy is consumable as either an audio-only podcast or a video podcast, both accessible at diversejoy.com. Diverse Joy is the official podcast of Inequity Agents of Change, a nonprofit devoted to the dissemination of evidence-based approaches to reduce bias, create inclusion, promote equity, and enhance diversity. All that good Jedi work.
Jedi work.
Learn more at biashabit.com. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
I was talking into the microphone. Do you need me to
No.
Do you need me to start over? I can start over easily.
Is this the one that migrates? I think it might be.
It has been migrating.
Yeah.